How's it going, everyone? Jesse Churchill here with Seeking What They Sought. Today is a big, hard-hitting conversation. We're going to talk about race. So that means we're going to talk about track and field. We're going to talk about swimming. We're going to talk about The Amazing Race, the TV show. We're going to talk about political races. We're going to talk about relay races and any other, like, obviously, I'm kidding. This is the bigger issue and the bigger topic surrounding race in America. And we know that it's a massive issue. This is not an all-encompassing conversation by any means. This is one of many of the conversations that needs to happen here in America. But as people who follow Jesus, we think it's very important that we center ourselves around listening and having a conversation that opens up our worldview and our understanding of other people. And so that's the main purpose behind all of this today. So to that end, we are having a conversation with Michael Nixon. He's the Vice President for Diversity and Inclusion at Andrews University. And Anthony and I today will be the ones having the conversation with him. And it's important to recognize a couple things before we get to this conversation. First of all, this was recorded before the Derek Chauvin trial really began and ended. And so that has recently come to an end, but we don't obviously talk about many of the things that have happened since the time that we recorded. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, I think it's really important for us to recognize as we go into this conversation that the conversation about race is not a political one. This is not about Democrats. It's not about Republicans. This is about listening to each other. It's about how we as humans treat each other. And as people who follow Jesus, it is important that we don't try and pick a side in the political sphere. It's important that we follow Jesus and the kingdom of God. And so we want to have nuanced opinions. We don't want to just completely wholesale buy any specific side. We want to have nuanced opinions, but we want it to be something that is seeing people as made in the image of God and their full potential. And so whatever that means, I know it's going to be different for different people, but it's important to recognize that we as hosts of this podcast and as friends who just have a conversation have very nuanced views. We hate certain things that one side says, and we love things the other side says, and it goes vice versa. And it's important to understand that, because as we go into this, it may sound like we're one-sided, or you may hear things that think that we support your side or someone else's side, but really, this is just one conversation out of many that that we ought to be having as people. So to that end, let's get into this conversation with Michael Nixon. Hey, everyone. Welcome to Seeking What They Sought. We are with Michael Nixon, who is the VP for Diversity and Inclusion at Andrews University. And I previously had thought he was a chaplain and got it wrong. And then we had a whole conversation. Anthony was right. He told me the right thing. But we're getting it right this time. So Michael is the VP for Diversity and Inclusion at Andrews University. So tell me a little bit, Michael, about your journey to becoming the VP at Andrews.
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on, guys. I appreciate being here with you. So the streamlined version is my family moved to this area, Berrien Springs, Michigan, the frozen tundra of Berrien.
Yes, sir.
Back in the late 90s, 98, when my father received a call to be the administrative chaplain here at AU. He's of course is a minister. And so that could be why there was some confusion there. I think I'm like the only person in my family who's not a pastor. So that could have been part of it as well, whether it was my dad or uncle. I have a few cousins that are doing it. It passed over me. So
you have the gravitas of a bishop.
Oh, I appreciate that.
And the beard.
I appreciate that. So. I receive it. Yeah, well, you know, got to grow that out, you know.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So we moved here. I was going into the sixth grade. So finished elementary school, high school, left for a couple of years, and then I finished undergrad here at Andrews. Then went on to law school in Chicago at the John Marshall Law School, and finished up there. Moved to the East Coast, lived in Central Jersey, not far from Princeton University, but I was working in New York City at the Fair Housing Justice Center, working as their legal coordinator and staff attorney. So housing discrimination, civil rights law cases, and was doing quite well, you know, and was pretty well settled with no real thoughts about coming here to AU. But then in June of 2017, accepted a call to be the VP for diversity and inclusion. And the creation of that position was sparked by, in large part, the Yiddish Time AU movement, which took place during February of 2017. So a few months before that.
Yeah, and you had been telling us a little bit about that, but could you kind of update our listeners on what happened there in February?
Yeah, absolutely. So the semi-quick version is, again, so this is February 2017, Black History Month, which is always a big celebration on our campus here at AU, being able to celebrate, cultural expression and worship from all across the African diaspora. It's always a beautiful celebration. So of course you have to remember that the month before this February would have been the inauguration of Donald Trump in January of 2017. And so that's sort of the backdrop of that particular year's Black History Month celebration. And so there was a lot of angst about what his election meant, given the way that he campaigned and some of the rhetoric during his campaign. And then even some of the early decisions that were being made, whether it was through cabinet picks or his first major, policy decision, which was around the Muslim ban and targeting some particular countries, mostly countries that have predominantly persons of color. And so there's some racial dynamics to that. And so in the midst of that sort of tension and backdrop, Dr. Jamie Kalasar, who's a senior pastor in the Dallas, Texas area, and a good friend of mine, was invited to be the main speaker for sort of that main weekend. And so it was a Thursday, Friday, Saturday night. And at the Thursday chapel, as a part of his remarks for that Thursday, he really took direct aim at President Trump and really called him to task for a lot of the rhetoric that he spewed during the campaign, as well as some of his early decisions and how he was sort of predicting that would have a negative, oppressive effect on, Black people and other persons of color. And I think ironically and somewhat tragically proved to be very prophetic in a lot of the things that he said, given the way that the next 4 years transpired. But of course, we have the good fortune of hindsight at this point. Of course, at that point, there were folks who were, I think, obviously supporters of President Trump that were a bit more optimistic as to what things may look like. So, the long story short is that after he delivered that chapel talk, there were folks that were really upset who were Trump supporters, Trump supporting students, and made that clear to administration had an issue again with a lot of what was shared in that particular talk. And so what ended up happening was the following Thursday at a chapel, our provost, Dr. Arthur, basically made remarks and I would say students who were uplifted and affirmed by what Dr. Kalasar said, took Dr. Arthur's remarks as more of an apology and somewhat of a retraction of those words, which caused them a deep amount of frustration and pain. And so 3 days later, they released the It Is Time AU video, which you can find on YouTube, and really asked for the university to take a really critical assessment of its legacy of racism, some of the past things that have happened in our history. In that video,
can I clarify something?
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. If I could clarify, you're saying that the remarks that Dr. Arthur made were taken by people who maybe felt that the previous speaker's remarks were offensive, that Dr. Arthur's words were better for them because they were in essence seeing it as an apology or a retraction. So whereas other students were like, hold up, we don't like that apology or retraction. And that's where the video came from.
Correct. Okay, so they essentially saw, I think, Dr. Arthur's words as, their perspective on it was that his words were capitulating to the complaints and frustrations of, you know, Trump supporting students and their parents who were calling outraged that someone would dare talk about, you know, President Trump from the pulpit and talk about politics or whatever the case may be. And so they ended up, you know, those nine students and one staff member ended up making a video in which they essentially said, you have 1 week to address those things. And that was, again, rooted in the fact that, you know, the chapel talk had happened and, you know, these students, in their opinion, received an apology for something in 1 week. And so it shouldn't take you longer than 1 week to apologize for, you know, decades of, you know, racism and oppression that has happened and that Black people have essentially taken in silence. And so now is the time for you to finally take stock of that and critically assess this legacy of racism and take positive steps forward. So having said that, you know, so that was released on like a Saturday. So the following Thursday at another chapel, so this is like a series of chapels here, our president, Dr. Luxton, delivered just really a powerful chapel talk, in which he started off by saying, you know, we will be okay. And, you know, delivering just a powerful message that she had really, she kind of sketched out some notes. I actually have a picture of the paper where she just sketched out some notes in the parking lot the morning of that day, that chapel, because she was receiving a lot of pressure. There was pressure from donors to not respond and not say anything. You know, there were threats that, you know, if you do respond or apologize for this, that I'm revoking my monetary support and those kinds of things. Wow. And so in the face of that, she you know, did apologize. And of course her chapel talk was the intro to a response video, which you could also find on YouTube and is on our website, in which the university formally apologized and responded to the requests made by the this time participants. And in addition to that, announced the creation of the position that I would ultimately apply for. And after, you know, a couple month process of interviewing and things of that nature, was offered and ultimately accepted. But the interesting thing is that I actually was watching that chapel from my office in New York as they decided to stream, because of course this had gotten, you know, it went sort of Adventist viral and it gotten sort of global attention. Right. And so everybody wanted to know, well, what's Andrew's going to do? What's going to happen? And so watched the live stream and was really deeply moved, having, you know, spent a significant amount of my upbringing in this community and knowing some of those old stories. To see the university actually acknowledge that in such a public way was pretty moving, and really cemented to me at that moment that, you know, there's some potential for God to do something really special at Andrews, having no idea that I would have anything to do with it. So that's the, I guess, the streamlined version of me ending up here.
That's awesome, man. I'm genuinely curious. I mean, obviously, that's what a crazy time for administration and for students and everybody as you walk through that season. And I do want to ask some questions about your work, you know, as the VP of diversity and inclusion. But if I could just go back and ask you a little bit about your work as a civil rights lawyer, you had mentioned. Sure. And if I could, I mean, some of what we wanted to talk about on this podcast was, you know, kind of just in general race, but thoughts from the last year and why is it so hard to have some conversation about race in the church? But you saying that you were a civil rights lawyer is maybe an opportunity to ask for some of the concrete examples that a lot of the country, myself included, wouldn't know about. Because you were saying you were working in the you're working with housing injustice,
sure,
or mm-hmm. housing equity. Yeah. And so could you share maybe just a couple of circumstances that would be helpful for other people understanding how race plays a part in all of that?
Great. So yeah, when I, it's a really good question. And so when I was sort of in the middle of law school, I knew that I wanted to do something that, you know, in the area of civil rights advocacy where I could help people, but really wasn't clear on what that, you know, could or should look like. It's a pretty broad area. So I took a class called Fair Housing and Fair Lending and went into it not really knowing much about the legacy of housing discrimination in our country. You know, I'd heard of the Fair Housing Act, which had passed in 68, knew that it was one of the, you know, civil rights acts or legislation that was passed in the wake of the assassination of Dr. King. But other than that, didn't really know that much about it. And so as I dove into it, though, what really fascinated me about housing discrimination was how covert in nature it is. You know, it's not one of those areas that is as blatantly in your face as like a racial slur or whatever the case may be. But it was one of the clearest examples of institutional and systemic racism that I've ever seen. And it really clarified for me what that does look like within society. And in particular, what it looks like in the North, because a lot of times when we think about like systems of oppression and racism, you know, you think slavery, you think the South, and that's sort of mm-hmm. the clearest thing that people think about. And so the idea is, you know, if that's eradicated, then systemic and institutional oppression no longer exists. So what happened when I moved to New York to start working at the Fair Housing Justice Center, I actually was born in upstate New York. My father was born in Brooklyn. So I have some New York roots. And, you know, oftentimes the city is thought of as like a melting pot. That's a phrase you'll hear a lot. And you oftentimes think of that as a positive thing. And it gives you this idea that, okay, you have people from all over the world that are living in harmony. It's the hustle and bustle, you know, it's Broadway, all this different stuff. But what I came to find out is that New York City was actually consistently in the top three of the most segregated cities in the United States for Black people and for Hispanics. And
wow, really?
And actually the majority, well, first of all three of the top three are in the North. So there's Chicago, where I went to law school, there's New York City, and then there's Milwaukee. And those are the top three most segregated cities in the country. And the majority of the top 10 are in the North. And so I'd say that housing discrimination is really, it's really a Northern issue in a lot of ways. Of course, it exists all over the country. But what I saw in doing my work in New York was actually quite startling. And I'll explain it to you this way. What we did, because of course, in New York City, the majority of the housing market is rental housing. You know, there's some home ownership in the suburbs, but when you're in the, you know, the five boroughs of the city, it's mostly people renting. And so what we would do is that we would send what we call testers into the housing market. The closest example to that that I could explain would be probably like a secret shopper that goes to do price checks or something like that. So this is essentially, you know, a person who is going into the housing market to in response to advertisements for available housing or whatever the case may be, just to see what information they're given. And so the way that we would do this is what are called match pair tests. So we would typically match a white tester, and it depends on what protected class we were investigating. So let's say we were doing an investigation into race discrimination. That's pertinent for our discussion. And we had reason to believe that a particular housing provider was discriminating against Black people in the housing market. So what we would do is we would match a Black tester with a white tester, and they would schedule an appointment with the same, you know, either real estate agent or landlord or whatever the case may be to explore potential openings. And one of the cool things about New York is that it's essentially a one-party consent state for recording. So you can record someone if you're in a conversation with them without their consent, and that's admissible as evidence. So we would send our testers out with actually FBI grade recording equipment, sometimes all the time audio, sometimes we would do video as well, to essentially capture the experiences that they had. And here's the thing about it. In the 3.5 years I worked there, you know, I never heard, you know, a Black person called a racial slur. I very rarely even heard a Black person be treated, you know, not courteously, or, you know, rebuffed, or whatever the case may be. You know, 9 times out of 10, what I would hear on recordings, because as a staff attorney, I would oftentimes now on the back end, you know, listen over the recordings as we're comparing the treatment to see if there was some sort of a case here. And we would repeat these like 4 or 5 times so that we could pick up on a pattern. We would never bring a case based off of one interaction. Yeah. But what we found was, for example, let's say, Anthony, you went into the housing market. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you met with a landlord, and the landlord would say to you, oh, yeah, we did have that ad for those 3 apartments this morning. But, man, we just rented them like, you know, a second before you got here. But why don't you give me your name, your number, your email? I'll put you on this waiting list. Mm-hmm. And we have stuff that opens up all the time. And as soon as something opens back up, I'm going to hit you up. You can come back and we'll get you all set. And so from your perspective, and it's the hustle and bustle of the city. So like when you're looking for an apartment, you need one now. So you're probably not going to think much of the fact that, oh yeah, well, you know, people fill units all the time. You're on to the next building, whatever the case may be. You'd have no idea that you were potentially just lied to. So what we would do is we would send in a white counterpart, let's say Kyle, who's someone that we, you know, we both know.
Yeah, for sure.
And, you know, to the same, you know, housing provider to ask about the same apartments, and that landlord showing him 3 apartments that are available and telling him, hey, you can rent this today if you want to.
Wow.
We also saw landlords actually, when they were willing to rent to African Americans, they would charge them higher rents. So we would call it essentially like a race tax for renting an apartment. So rather than, you know, paying, you know, $1 million for a 1-bedroom, because it's New York, you'd pay $2 million. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, exactly. So those are obviously facetious numbers, but they would, the point is they would charge more on different occasions. And, you know, I wouldn't have believed that this was happening were we not to have this stuff on tape. And I share that to say, and this is something that happened pervasively. This wasn't like a one-off thing. This was all across the city. This is a, you know, this is not a Democrat Republican thing. You know, it's a mostly, you know, Democrat run state politically. So this isn't about, you know, going after the, you know, the Republicans or whatever the case may be. This is something that's deeply embedded in the housing market and the way that that business operates in our country. And it's very pervasive. And we also, we saw the same thing in the lending market for folks who are interested in home ownership. When we would set up tests with banks for that, and these are much more sophisticated tests, we would, in every key measure, when we had a black tester and a white tester, we would set up the black tester to be more, to have a better profile. So they'd have more money in savings, more income, a better credit score, less debt, all of those different categories. And we would match them up with white testers. And more often than not, what we would find were loan officers being willing to lend more money to those white testers, even though their financial profiles were worse. Which of course, when you get pre-qualified, they'd be more willing to pre-qualify them, which of course, now when you have a pre-qualification letter, you can go to a real estate officer and they can start showing you houses based off of how they pre-qualified you. Mm-hmm. And that of course dictates what neighborhood you can look for houses in, because they're not going to show you houses in a neighborhood that you haven't been pre-qualified for a loan. And so in that way, you know, of course you've probably heard of the historic phrase of redlining. It's a new form of steering people into different areas and communities, which of course has a super long-term effect on the trajectory of that person's life and their family. Because now again, whether you're thinking about the owner, you know, the home ownership context or the rental context, you know, when you look at the foundation of where someone lives, now this affects their access to employment opportunities, to transportation, to nutrition, to healthcare, to education, the school system that their kids are in, which has an indelible effect on their future. You know, the amount of, you know, the sort of, you know, resale value and capital that you have, you know, in the future when you may want to resell your home or whatever the case may be, or folks that, you know, want to take out a second mortgage to start a business or something like that, which could be more feasible with one home as opposed to another. So it's a, for me, you know, the housing sector gave me a very clear view into sort of the foundational level of how the trajectory of people's lives can be altered based off of one decision or one decision that they're steered into. And then a series, you know, of events can unfold as a result of that, that can set them up for success or failure going forward. So, you know, hopefully that gives you some insight into the experience of doing that work.
Wow, man.
That's nuts, man. I mean, that's not the stuff that, well, like I said, I'm so glad you shared that, because that's the stuff that most of us who aren't part of the Black community probably maybe haven't even heard of. And just the insidiousness of it. Like, I don't want to overstate things. I hate exaggerating things, but I feel like that's at least a too kind of a word to say how messed up that is, because it is with all of the guise of like, hey, yeah, come back next week, or hey, if we have more space, but you know, the unspoken is we have no intention of calling you, but a white guy comes in and there's just a different thing. Now, could I ask you just a quick follow-up? Do you think that most of it was intentional, or was it just like people's perspectives of someone has unthought of bias, and so they just treat someone different? Or do you think there was a specific level of overtness to what they were doing?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to say. You know, I think in some cases it was clear that there was some personal intent involved. I think I'm much more prone to suggest that it's more of a systemic and structural issue in which you have these individual players who are, some of it goes to the training of like loan officers, for example, or, you know, folks who are, you know, real estate brokers or things of that nature. You know, there's a lot of roots of, you know, racism and prejudice in even the inception of, you know, like the National Association of Realtors and things of that nature. And so it's sort of in some, you know, unconscious ways built into how you're trained to do your job. Or what we've seen actually is that there are some people who in some ways take it upon themselves to assume that, oh, well, you know, hey, Michael's here and, you know, he'd probably be more comfortable in a Black neighborhood, so I'm going to steer him in that direction, you know. Or, gotcha. You know, or a white person that comes in, oh, hey, you know, you don't want this school district, so let me move you over here, that kind of a thing. And so I think sometimes people are maybe quote unquote wanting to be helpful, but are doing it in a way that's obviously illegal, and is, you know, something that can end up really damaging people in the long run. And so, you know, I don't think that it's, you know, you have a bunch of folks that are running around wanting to be quote unquote intentionally racist, but it is embedded in our culture and in the system of how we operate. And so if you don't have a critical lens to be able to pick up on that, it'll be very easy for somebody to just kind of go with the flow and perpetuate it.
I was going to ask Mike, as you were talking, it was reminding me of the book The Color of Law by Richard Rothstein, which I know you know of.
Yeah.
And that's the whole premise of that book, right? Which is like redlining, the history of it is housing discrimination is so deeply embedded within the whole system all the way from its inception, from the very beginning, that it almost can't help but affect how, you know, the way that the industry works today. And that's essentially what you experience, is what you're saying.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And that's a really powerful book. And I mean, the reality of housing discrimination in this country is that, you know, at its inception, you know, looking at, you know, the 1930s and 40s and beyond, it was all architected by the government, you know? So this wasn't, you know, this wasn't just like private actors who were, I think, of course, on the back end of that, private actors like joined in and perpetuated it. But, you know, redlining is something that was done by the government in marking certain neighborhoods in red and deciding that, you know, these government programs that were offering, you know, like through the GI Bill or through the New Deal, in which they were offering, you know, money for folks to buy mortgages, we're essentially saying that we will not do it in these neighborhoods, nor will we offer it to these people. Because they're only allowed to live in this neighborhood, which we've marked in red, which we're not going to invest in. And so it's not rocket science to match those maps up with a map today of what people would call the quote unquote ghetto, and see why those communities were left behind and others were able to develop and flourish. So, so when people start talking about things like restorative justice and reparations and things of that nature, you know, they're not just saying it because they want some handout from someone for nothing, but it is to take stock of what has actually taken place and to remedy what has been stolen. And there's a lot of, you know, good reporting and good books like The Color of Law, which can help us, you know, more contemporarily understand what's been going on for a long time.
Isn't it true that the GI Bill, you had men who had served in World War II that were coming back, and as black men, they weren't even getting some of the housing assistance or mortgage assistance that they were entitled to? Am I off on that?
No, you're absolutely right. And so there's a lot of reporting on that, but a good recent video that's gotten a lot of attention. And I forget the guy's name right now, but he's the creator of VeggieTales, ironically.
Phil Vischer.
Phil Vischer. He's done a two-part, you know, series on, you know, just looking at the legacy of racism. And he actually talks a lot about that in the first part. I forget which state it is, but there's one particular state where they had given, like, you know, something like 50,000 mortgages through the GI Bill in this one particular state. And black people in that state had gotten like 30 of them or something crazy like that. So, I mean, you know, black veterans were just excluded from all of that. And so, and I know a lot of folks politically talk a lot about supporting our troops and veterans, but when you bring stuff like that up, you know, you don't get as much vigor, I guess you can say.
Yeah, unfortunately. It's so interesting. One of the questions we wanted to talk with you about was, why has it been so hard to talk about race within the church? But I wanted to kind of ask that as a tag on to what we were just talking about, because what you've just stated to us is such a visceral example of racism that isn't overt in its, like you're saying, racial slurs towards somebody. And it's not even, it's very easily played off as, oh, no, it wasn't because they were black. It was just, you know, time, or, you know, the other guy came in 10 minutes later and three opened up, or what. You could come up with so many excuses for why that wasn't housing and housing inequity or something wrong. And in that, it's even more dangerous, because you can't deny I said the N-word, but you can deny I treated someone differently because of their race.
Right.
But so then it's so interesting, because you've brought up these very visceral, in your face examples of current situations. These are not, you know, the 60s. These aren't the 40s. This is, you know, what it sounds like this decade or this previous decade in New York and beyond. Do you think that, is it possible that one of the reasons that race conversations in the church, and this is just one, obviously there's so many, but race conversations in the church tend to be divisive, or they can cause church splits, or people just don't want to talk about it at the very least, is because racism is termed as when someone says the N-word, when someone dresses up in a white hood and burns a cross, like that's racism.
Yeah.
And this other stuff isn't racism. And in essence, like that, is it down to the definition? I wonder.
I think that's part of it, man. I think it is, because, you know, to your point, as you set up the question, I think the majority of people, and particularly for Christians in the church, when you think about the topic of racism, the thing that you think about are probably what I would call on the interpersonal level. So mm-hmm. a racial slur, or, you know, you walking up to a person of a different race and they, you know, they grasp their purse or, you know, something like that, like the things that you can see or you can hear, or being followed in a store, or, you know, being pulled over all these different times by the police for nothing or whatever the case may be. Those are things that are, I guess, easier to pick up on, or things you can see more easily. And so I think that oftentimes in the Christian church, and I think some of this has to do with the fact that I think Christianity over time, particularly around the rise of the religious right, you know, which was sort of in some ways the response to the civil rights era of the 60s. Like, as you're getting into, you know, the 70s and sort of the movement that I would say led to the election of Ronald Reagan and that whole movement and you know, them really, you know, take, you know, moving more into this like Christian nationalist identity politics, is that also I think that American Christianity and evangelicalism moved into much more of a individualistic pursuit. It wasn't very
communal
other than when we, you know, evangelicals were describing sort of the parameters of what it means to be within this faith community. And so in some ways,
the boundaries,
exactly, it's more describing those boundaries and saying, you know, okay, if you're able to, you know, keep to these tenets, you know, you can be in, but if you're not, then you're out, sort of a thing. And so you're starting to view your morality and your religion and your fidelity to scripture as this individualistic pursuit, that so long as I personally can match myself up to these different creeds or tenets that we've developed, then, you know, hey, I'm God's man, I'm God's woman, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. But when you start to, you know, be introduced with, you know, things like, you know, institutional or systemic racism, and the way that it's perpetuated by different systems, and how I dare say even the church has been complicit over time in the creation of those systems and the pervasiveness of them, as an individual Christian, because now I've sort of been conditioned to look at my religion as an individual pursuit, I think it's hard for a lot of people to step into a space where they're saying, well, hey, I don't see how I've individually contributed to that, so why should I bother with it? You know, because that's not, you know, that's not what this is about, you know, for me. You know, I'm a good person. For us, as you know, for folks who, you know, I go to church on a particular day. I eat a particular diet, whatever the case may be. I have, you know, hey, I have a few white friends. I have a few black friends. You know, I post on social media or whatever that looks like for that particular person, right, all across, this is all across the spectrum, you know? And I mentioned the social media thing because, you know, I think we have a lot of, you know, microwavable activism or sort of drive-by protesting, where, you know, it's just sort of, hey, I'll put this thing up and yeah. But then it stops there. You know what I'm saying? And I don't know how much better that is than a person who, you know, just doesn't want to talk about it at all because, you know, of their fragility or their upbringing or whatever it is. So I think that, again, we aren't introduced with a more holistic view of what racism is or what the four levels of it are. And we assume oftentimes that, yeah, if I don't do those really ugly things that I've seen on TV or that I've read about in the history book, then I'm not a racist and I don't have to think about racism.
What you just, oh man, Michael, that's such a,
there's so much in there.
You just connected Christian nationalism and the individualizing of our faith to the conversation about race today. And I think that that's a incredible incredibly true thing. Like as soon as you were talking about it, just it all seems to fall into place, because as we individualize our faith and we loose ourselves from the binds of Christian community to a certain degree, we end up just making it about us. And then so when someone's saying, oh, well, you're part of a system, it's like, no, I'm not part of a system. I'm an individual.
Right.
Whereas, especially if you read scripture, especially if you're reading the Old Testament, it's very understood. This is not individual actions. This is us as a community. We're doing something in the world. We're creating a space. We're creating a way of living in the world. We're creating an environment.
Yeah.
And when they're not,
we all have a part to play in that.
That's exactly what the prophets are critiquing when they're not, when they are oppressing the poor, when they are oppressing the marginalized. That's what the prophets are calling out, like as a community, not you as an individual, but as a community, you're doing this and God's judgment is on that.
Yeah, and like the one individual can be like, well, I'm not doing that specific thing, but it's like, no, you're part of a system that is doing it and you're complicit in it. And that's a I'd never connected those two specific dots, but that's really
that's good.
Yeah, wow, that's something else.
Mike, you said a lot there. I feel like there's there could be so much. This could go on for a long time, but I want to go back to a conversation actually you and I had a while back. It was around a fireplace at Kyle's house, actually. When you were sort of talking about the formation of regional conferences, and that was really educational to me as a Black Adventist, because I didn't know the history of that. And so I wondered if you could walk us through, because you briefly just said there have been times when the church has been complicit. And so I wondered how, maybe if you could outline us just a brief, like, outline of that.
Yeah.
That would be
absolutely. Yeah. I would love to. And real quick, before I dive into that, I should just say for folks who are interested in maybe a broader, even beyond Adventism perspective of Christian complicity with racism, I would highly recommend Jamar Tisby's The Color of Compromise. Because he sort of does a historical survey going back to like the mid 1600s in this country of Christian complicity with racism. It's a difficult and sobering read, but I think a necessary read in particular for us as Christians. But in regards to some of the particulars of the Adventist story around this, so the short version is, you know, going back to at least 1889, you know, there was a gentleman by the name of Charles Kinney.
You just said the short version is going back to 1889.
I'm gonna run through it pretty quick, because the story kind of is between 1899 and like 1943. So that's sort of like
no rush.
The package of years there. But there's a gentleman by the name of Charles M. Kinney, who was one of the first Black ordained ministers in the Adventist Church. And he's making some, this is actually at his ordination service at the, I think it was the Southern Conference camp meeting that year. And so that year he was making some public statements before his ordination in the presence of a gentleman by the name of Robert M. Kilgore, who was the leader of the Southern Conference at the time and the Southern work. He was essentially making comments to the extent of, because of course it was a segregated campground. And so members of Kinney's church, Black members who were coming to support him, had to be seated elsewhere. They weren't allowed inside the main sanctuary or tent or whatever the case may be.
I'm sorry, this is
so
in-
you're saying that-
No, you go.
Anthony, go for it.
This is in 1889, correct?
This is in 1889, yeah. So yeah. This is sort of like, go ahead, Jesse.
He's speaking to the entire meeting as a Black man, but his Black counterparts have to be seated.
Elsewhere.
I know what happened, but it's just to look back with different eyes at that than what they were looking at in the time is just wild. Yeah.
It's a striking scene, I'm sure. And, you know, So essentially, you know, I won't run through the whole conversation, but he basically says something to the effect of, to Kilgore and really to the other folks who were there, that he said that the third angel's message in particular has the power to eradicate the racial prejudice in the church and in America, if it is really, if it really impacts or takes hold of the hearts of people who get hold of the truth, essentially. And goes beyond that to say that it was his prayer that the church's answer on this segregation question would not drive Black persons in particular away from the truth. And so that began to spark some dialogue and conversations over time where Black leaders in the then known Adventist church would come to, you know, General Conference leadership to essentially ask the question, you know, can we be recognized as a part of the Adventist church? Because, you know, they were pastoring, you know, I guess basically Adventist companies at that point, and they were wanting to have those churches join the then established conferences, which, you know, were state conferences. Those were the only conferences that existed at the time. And the church refused to recognize them, essentially, again, because of the fact that they're being led by Black pastors. And so over time, they kept asking that question. And then so finally, probably like around the 20s, 1920s, they start shifting their requests to say, all right, well, look, you know, we've been asking this question for a number of years now. You all don't want us to be part of the state conferences. Would you establish us within our own conference so that we can be a part of the church? And, you know, literally, bro, they just wanted to be recognized as Adventists. Like, that's literally what was going on here. And so they're like, you know, if we can't be a part of the state conference system, then just establish us in our own conference and we'll go from there. And the answer to that was no for a while. And the white leadership was saying, no, we're not going to do that, blah, blah, blah.
I'm going to say white leadership, that's on the GC level, is saying no?
GC, yeah, GC level. These conversations are happening with the GC, maybe sometimes by proxy through the NAD as well, but it's mostly happening through the GC. Because, you know, although the church was, you know, still growing and expanding at the time, and so the GC was much more involved in some of those establishments or whatever the case may be of churches and conferences. So as we get more towards like probably the late 20s, what you start to see is sadly Kinney's prediction start to come true. You had some prominent Black ministers, one in particular by the name of J.K. Humphrey, who was a very well-known evangelist in the New York area, that ends up leaving the Adventist church just over the racism. It just like couldn't take it anymore, left. And there was a number of others who left as well. But it wasn't until sort of the early 1940s, like around 1943, you may have heard about the Lucy Byard incident. And essentially what happened is that Lucy Byard, who was a fair-skinned Black person, went to the Washington Sanitarium or Washington Adventist Hospital and had like pneumonia-like symptoms and was wanting to get admitted. And so had initially been admitted, but once the hospital staff realized that she was Black, de-admitted her because, again, Black persons were not allowed to be serviced at the Washington, this is Washington, D.C., Adventist Hospital, and ended up pointing her in the direction of the Freedmen's Hospital, which was, you know, I guess, you know, some distance from there, and ended up, you know, probably a week or so later dying from the symptoms of her sickness. And so that incident in particular sparked the creation of what was called the Layman's Leadership Council, and they developed a document called the Four Freedoms and asked the question, shall these four freedoms be established in the Adventist Church? And one of those requests was, again, around this whole conversation of establishing what they called at the time colored conferences. And so finally at the spring meeting of the General Conference in April of 1943, the delegates finally decided to allow the creation of those conferences, the first of which would become Lake Region Conference here in this area. And that was the reason for the creation of those conferences ultimately. It wasn't that Black members of our church wanted to be separate or had an interest in their having their own thing or whatever the case may be. It was really because after being told no for so long, they felt that it was the next best option to be recognized as Adventist.
That's crazy.
It's wild.
It feels unbelievable that we would do that, and yet, you know, the fact that it's there means that it's free.
Yeah.
We're very capable of doing it. Now, we have that within the Adventist church. Outside of the Adventist church, I know that there is still quite a separation, maybe not in the same entity-like way, where we have like regional conferences specifically. Maybe, mm-hmm. I don't know if other churches have that type of thing specifically. But what I have found quite interesting, at least in this last year, is the difficulty. I don't know the right words. I want to use words carefully, but the difficulty of having conversations surrounding race because of a lot of what you said about the individualistic side of things. Like, I'm not being racist, but it's even about like the message, like or the type of racism that is argued to be in existence in America. So here you've talked about, you know, black Seventh Day Adventists did not want to start their own thing, but were forced into it because they weren't allowed to be part of the thing,
right?
In essence, and you've talked about housing inequality and just the obvious things that are happening there, and yet many people would just say, well, racism doesn't exist the same way anymore. That'd be an argument for many people, or it's a few bad apples is what's kind of stated. And so we can look back at what you just described with regional conferences and be like, well, that was a system. And yes, that was kind of the prevailing attitude. But now it's just a few people specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And for instance, a system of ideas called critical race theory has been a pretty prevalent conversation recently. And in my experiences with that, especially with evangelical churches or leaders or things like that, it has been a
controversial.
How do I say this? Mm-hmm. It's not even controversial. It's just flat out like
rejected
by many people, because in essence, it gets this label of like Marxism or things like that. And as soon as you attach that label to anything, you know, you're gonna lose, you know,
right.
a ton of people.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But that leads to the question of, if I could ask, first of all, if you could kind of define what critical race theory is, so we can kind of have a base to have a couple of other questions off of. It is very controversial. At least both sides are like, well, one side's like, this is the way it is to some degree. The other side's like, mm-hmm. this is the worst theory ever.
Sure. No, really good question. So, and I jotted down some notes on this particular point because I want to make sure I do I do CRT justice, and then, you know, broaden it out and maybe answer some other questions. And so, critical race theory, really in a nutshell, the definition I would give is that critical race theory examines the intersection of race, racism, and US law and public policy. So that's essentially what critical race theory does. So in other words, it looks at how US laws and public policy, and this is in the opinion of a critical race theorist. So what a critical race theorist would do is look at US laws and public policy and looks at how US law and public policy has been manipulated and constructed over the years to preserve privilege for those who are considered white at the expense of people of color. So that's essentially what the lens that a critical race theorist uses. So for example, they would look at, you know, how did racism infect US law and policy through slavery and Jim Crow segregation? And then how does racism continue to cripple our legal, educational, political, corporate and public health institutions? We talked about things like housing discrimination, those kinds of things. So basically what critical race theory does is it helps to tie a connection point between these different eras of American history in particular. And it helps us understand how racism manifests itself in that particular era and in that particular time. And so one of the more, you know, there are a few prominent professors or scholars who were at the foundation of the creation of critical race theory. One was a gentleman by the name of Derrick Bell, who was a professor at Harvard for a long period of time. Richard Delgado is also well known. Jean Stefanchik. And so I actually have a quote from Delgado, which can maybe help understand, you know, describe the movement as well. And so Delgado said, "The critical race theory movement is a collection of activists and scholars interested in studying and transforming the relationship among race, racism, and power. The movement considers many of the same issues that conventional civil rights and ethnic studies discourses take up, but places them in a broader perspective that includes economics, history, context, group and self-interest, and even feelings and the unconscious. Unlike traditional civil rights, which stresses incrementalism and step-by-step progress, critical race theory questions the very foundations of the liberal order, including equality theory, legal reasoning, enlightenment, rationalism, and neutral principles of constitutional law." So I've said all that, put it kind of all the academics on the table, but I'd say beyond that in a nutshell, that part there where Delgado talks about questioning the very foundation of the liberal order, what it's saying is that, you know, racism is not something that people and institutions and countries even just do. It's not like an action. It's actually a character trait. It's an embedded part of the foundation of who we are as a society, as individuals, and the very foundations of the structures that exist. And so, for example, one of the fundamental tenets for critical race theory, number one, is that racism is ordinary. So in some ways, critical race theory tries to de-emotionalize the discussion, for lack of a better term, around racism. It's an ordinary thing. It's not aberrational. It's the normal way that society does business. It's the common everyday experience of most people of color in this country. So one of the examples of that people talk a lot about is like microaggressions or everyday acts of discrimination, which can have a compounding effect. And now, so this is what critical race theory does. It's not just these little microaggressive actions that someone endures, but studies, you know, and healthcare studies show that when you compile those acts on top of each other and you have this compounding effect, that those things actually have a negative effect on the health of persons of color. So critical race theory is helping you to tie these, you know, actions that can look like individual actions into the broader implications for individuals as well as, you know, groups of individuals within society. Hopefully that's clear.
For instance, something that I have come to learn over these last few years is, for instance, especially amongst black women, hairstyles has been a huge thing that for those of us outside the black community, it's like you do your hair in whatever style, but not even realizing that in a lot of places, black hairstyles, both men and women, but especially in the female side of things, have been just plain out outlawed or not allowed within the work context or things like that, or at least the social pressure of doing your hair differently. And then so what you're saying is that critical race theory says, oh, it's not just the boss saying you can't wear your hair like that. It's saying that, well, that's tied to the housing conversation, then that's tied to the redlining that caused caused some of these ghettos,
all interconnected,
the policing of those ghettos and the poverty and all that. So it's all connected, and it's not just what it also sounds like it's saying is that it's not just a person who has to live that out. It's maybe a group of people or a person who put that into law code, and then it's perpetuated by even people who aren't trying to be racist.
Absolutely.
Is that, would that be a fair?
Beautifully said.
That was great.
That's exactly what it is. It's and the key word, which is the short version, I guess, of what you're describing, which you described so beautifully, is just that word intersectionality. That's what it means. Mm-hmm. So you just described, you know, one of the examples of what it means to be a Black woman so well. But just even at the foundation of the experience of a Black woman, it's not only that they're Black, but they're also a woman. And so there's a particular experience that Black women have that I can't, you know, that I can't relate to. One of the parts of critical race theory is called the voice of color thesis. And essentially what that thesis says is that because of the different histories and experiences with oppression that, you know, Black persons, also, you know, folks who were First Nations persons, American Indians, Asian, Latino, whatever, folks from that community, you know, writers and thinkers from those communities will be able to communicate to their white counterparts matters that those white counterparts are unlikely to know. So, you know, although, you know, you or I could probably describe what you just described in some clarity, one of our Black sisters would be able to step into this space and say, well, mm-hmm. that's what that's really like because I've lived it. Mm-hmm. And so right. critical race theory tries to empower people to really now have the main voice in articulating their own story, because there's the old saying that, you know, the people who won the war get to write the history, you know, mm-hmm. and essentially what they're saying is, you know, the people in power get to craft the narrative. And so what critical race theory tries to do is to step into that and say, you know, we're not going to, you know, allow this revisionist history to continue to be perpetuated. We're going to allow people to become the main characters in their own stories once again and tell the truth about what they've experienced and what they've seen, because at the root of any kind of real positive change has to be truth telling. I mean, that's the foundation that it's built upon.
That's really good.
Mm. Now, it's the hard part that I've noticed in this last year. So I was telling you earlier, Michael, I've grown up in the white community. I mean, I've shared this with people before, but one time on accident, I was like, us white people, because that's just how steeped I have been. For anyone who doesn't know, I'm brown. I'm racially ambiguous enough that nobody really knows what I am. I've been asked if I was Middle Eastern or Indian or Hispanic.
What are you, Jesse?
Always grown up.
I don't even know.
My mom is from Sri Lanka. My dad's white. So that's what I am. I'm half Asian, half white.
Gotcha.
But also even then, it's like I'm half Asian, but not the Asian that people usually think of when you say Asian.
Mm.
So that means that I've kind of skated, you know, in this racially ambiguous area and haven't experienced a lot of the things that other people have. But it also means that the way I've often thought about race is from the perspective of people who don't know what racism is from a lot of predominantly white culture. And one thing that I've noticed is a feeling amongst the white community of being called racist. And maybe it's a problem of definition. Maybe it's a problem of what we would consider racism. But for instance, again, if we're defining racism as it's when you have overt prejudice against another race, that's racism. So then if I say it a racial slur, or I treat someone different, if I clutch my purse when they go by, whatever it is, that's racism. Whereas I'm not a racist. But it feels like, and I can just tell you the feelings based off of conversation with people, there is a really deep feeling of defensiveness amongst a lot of the white population, because like, I'm not racist. I haven't done any of that stuff. I'm not that kind of person. I love Black people. I have Black friends. And, you know, saying all these things that sometimes are considered, you know, it's like, well, you saying you have Black friends can feel like it's just you're just saying that I have my two Black friends and that's it.
I had a black president a few years ago.
yeah, exactly. Racism can't exist anymore. But I'm trying to say this in with the best of intentions and understanding people, especially in my church community or my friends or family who are they are living with the best of intentions.
Sure.
And now they're being called racist because someone got killed. I'm just saying this from the perspective of someone who's white, because a Black man was killed by police in Minnesota, and there's been others of those. but why am I a racist now? Mm. And could you speak to that a little bit? Is that a healthy thing? Is not even healthy isn't the right word. Is that something that, is that the kind of rhetoric that's helpful? Is it true? Like, would you agree with that, but then redefine racism? Like, how do you deal with that yourself?
Yeah, no, it's a really important question. So to borrow one of the concepts from critical race theory that we just talked about, one of the things that I try to help people understand, once again, as critical race theory would say, is that racism is ordinary. And I think that's something that even, you know, Black persons need to learn and understand, because, you know, I can understand the negative feeling that perhaps someone can have when they feel like someone is weaponizing a word like "you're a racist" to make them feel bad. Now I would caution folks to try to maybe lean in a bit more and understand what somebody's trying to say to them, which does take some level of personal and intellectual humility. I do understand that. But what I think that in particular, you know, our white brothers and sisters do have to understand is that, so the conversation about race and racism for Black people is always going to be way higher stakes, because it's not something that we can opt in and out of. And again, people have very particular experiences around this stuff due to the way that our country and society has been constructed. And so sometimes, just as much as they would want someone to maybe quote unquote not jump to a conclusion or you know, call them a racist in the way that they're hearing that, it may not be the way it's being said, I would encourage folks to try to you know, take a more long-suffering approach with people to think through, okay, what could be the better intention than what I'm hearing right now? So again, I think helping folks understand that, again, racism is ordinary, you know. So I think, you know, you've heard some people talk about the fact that, you know, we all have some level of prejudice. Another way to put that is internalized racism. We all have that. That's something that we all share in. And so, you know, if somebody were to call me a racist, I would probably say, well, yeah, by some definitions, I probably am, you know, but by others, you know, I would say that I'm not, or that I'm fighting to be anti-racist. And I think that one of the things that, in particular, Dr. Ibram Kendi's work, How to Be an Anti-Racist, is helping us to clarify, is that this category of not racist doesn't really exist, you know, in practical terms. Due to the way that racism being ordinary works in both ways. Not only is it ordinary for folks to have been shaped by racism and therefore to have some internalized racism or prejudice, it also, according to critical race theory, can show up anywhere, you know, and so it being identified shouldn't be super groundbreaking, because if we have an understanding of history and the way our country's been constructed, identifying racism in a particular area isn't as groundbreaking as maybe it was before. It doesn't mean that it isn't, you know, shocking and painful sometimes, but it shouldn't be out of the ordinary for us, because it's so ordinary. It's everywhere. So we can't assume that any one of us is superhuman enough to be able to opt out of that. So I think the choice that we all have to make, whether you're Black or white or Asian or whatever your racial or ethnic background is each day, how am I taking intentional steps to overcome my prejudice or bias, to create more equitable and inclusive spaces wherever it is that I am or wherever God has placed me? Because again, going back to, you know, I think the more that we move our focus, particularly around our Christian identity, away from our individualistic pursuits for making ourselves morally acceptable, and we move more towards King's vision for the for the beloved community. And that's actually one of the, I'll actually send it to you guys. Robert Chowromero, he's a professor in UCLA. He's also a Christian. He's developed what he calls a framework, a formal framework of critical race theory in Christianity. And there's six tenets of it. And the sixth tenet, he actually does call the beloved community. And it's based off of the biblical witness of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And how it's able to, and I'll just read a part of it here for you. I just pulled it up.
Yeah, please.
And what Romero says here is that the goal of critical race theory in Christianity is the beloved community envisioned by scripture and the biblical witness of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And he puts some biblical examples in parentheses. Done in the spirit of love and the empowerment of Jesus Christ, the ultimate goal of CRT in Christianity is the reconciliation of all people from every cultural and ethnic background. CRT in Christianity celebrates and embraces the diverse God-given cultures of the world, but it is not ethnocentric. It seeks the shalom and reconciliation of all humanity in Jesus Christ. This unifying and hopeful eschatological vision represents a distinct contribution to the broader field of critical race theory. And so I just think that's beautiful. And
good.
Essentially, it's the gospel. You know, it's not,
yeah.
You guys are both ministers. I mean, you've probably said something like this in a multitude of your different sermons, you know? And so it's just helping people to understand how this framing can just better help us understand the world, help us understand some of the deficiencies in how humanity interacts with one another. And the more, again, we can move the discussion away from how do I personally feel, or how does this label personally make me feel, but to understand more, okay, how can I become a part of the kind of community that celebrates and embraces all people, which also means embracing their pain. And it's not just embracing what we say should be the best in them and forcing people to come each week and only show to us the comfortable and better looking parts of what makes them who they are. But it means when they're hurting, I hurt. When they struggle, I struggle. When they feel oppressed, I join alongside them in combating that oppression. That's the way of Christ. That's the beloved community.
Yeah.
And so if we are to be those kind of Christ followers, just like in any other area of our life, we can't carve this out. You know, we can't act as if it's not happening. And I think the more that we do that, hopefully the less that folks who can sometimes feel, you know, some fragility or some hard feelings around some of these different labels, can start to understand how their engagement in a more broad conversation about these issues can expand not just the field of critical race theory, so that critical race theorists can understand, oh, there's some Christians who are actually open to and about this business as well, but it can also benefit us and Christianity at large and the spreading of the message of the gospel.
Mike, if I can synthesize and then, yeah, what you just said is, everything you said is so strong. Essentially, what I hear you saying, it's super countercultural, bro, to like, I feel like to current sort of progressive, liberal, more cancel culture-y sort of a perspective, because you're essentially saying, let's, you know, and you know, you're representing Romero. That was his name, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you're representing Romero, essentially saying the tenets of CRT needs to fit within the context and schema, essentially, of the gospel itself.
Yeah.
And when we present it through the lens of the gospel, through the lens of God's vision of reconciling all humanity together, then when we're able, essentially in like non-pastory terms, in non-theological words, if we're able to speak it through the lens of the gospel, then that's a way to have those conversations, and they won't be as threatening. Because I,
right.
And I think I say that because I also, while I am a black man, I grew up in similar spaces to Jesse. And so I think because of that, you know, there is a lot of code switching I've experienced in my life, but also being able to kind of speak the language of the majority because I was raised in those spaces, and for them to feel like I'm a non-threatening voice. And so to have that, I feel like I've experienced similar things where people have expressed to me, church members have expressed to me, it seems so aggressive. It seems so, it's hard to hear because of the words, because of the words seem so accusatory, aggressive, like I'm the problem individually, when, as Jesse expressed, maybe they're feeling like, but I didn't do anything. So, yeah. So essentially what I hear you saying is to couch it in that language of the gospel, that's the way to kind of break through that barrier that so often goes between, you know, people.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. And an additional thing I would add to that is helping people to recognize that there's a difference between, I guess, the category of being a white person and whiteness, and how whiteness. So there's actually a really powerful article that was written by a professor by the name of Cheryl Harris, and it was called Whiteness as Property. And essentially the idea of that article was to help folks understand that the category of whiteness historically has been used as essentially a property interest in US history to, you know, as the basis for inequitable distribution of socioeconomic and political benefits, you know, throughout time. We've talked about that a lot during our conversation, so I won't rehash that. And so this could hopefully even help people in their intersection with conversations around the concept of privilege, because when we talk about privilege, what we aren't saying is that people who are white have to feel like personally guilty that there's some inherent privileges in being white, but it's recognizing and understanding the way that that racial category has been used as property throughout our country's history for the advancement of certain people and the oppression of others. And so in some ways,
If I could ask a clarifying question about property, do you mean in the context of like commodity, where it's
commodity?
It is something that it's something that I have in my possession that I don't even mean to have. I just have it.
Right.
And so when I go to get a loan, it's this invisible transaction that's happened that I'm not even aware of. Right. Where I'm white, I show up to this person, they're not concerned about anything, you know, because I'm part of the majority. Whereas someone who's black is coming without that commodity and therefore missing out or being treated differently based on not having that property. Is that a fair
use
of that?
Absolutely. So it's something you possess. So those who possessed whiteness in the eyes of the law, you know, have always been viewed as full humans. And we're entitled to citizenship, the right to vote, property ownership, et cetera. And then you have, on the other hand, those who would not fit into that category of whiteness and those especially who are legally defined as black, they actually being seen as chattel or as property. And so, you know, one of the things that Harris actually talks about is she says something to the effect of, basically, you know, slavery now, human chattel slavery as a system of property facilitated the merger of white identity and property. Whiteness was the characteristic or the attribute or the property or the possession of free human beings. And blackness was the possession of those who were dictated and determined to not be free. And so, so what oftentimes we're talking about in critical race theory or conversations about systemic and institutional racism is largely in regards to the possession of whiteness and not something in regards to the
personal fault,
the goodness or the wickedness of any individual white person. Okay. And I think that's important to say, because it can be easy to hear the demonization of just being white, and it's like, well, I didn't choose to be white, and you know, I'm here and you're telling me that, you know, I'm the problem. And it's like, no, you know, you individually aren't necessarily the problem, but the possession of whiteness and how that's been used in our country's history is the problem. And until we address that in some critical ways, we're not going to be able to restructure and to repair a lot of the damage that that possession of whiteness has done to our society and our culture.
Mike, what I really want to ask you, and I don't mean this as a joke, what I really want to ask you is, so how do we solve this? But we have 10 minutes and I don't want to ask you that question, and that I don't want to leave it with some weird space there. Yeah. And obviously nobody has a solution specifically, sure, the solution. But what I did want to ask you as maybe something that can give us space to move forward from here is, at the individual level, what is something, is it a heart position? Is it something someone can do? Is it something that maybe a worldview that we choose to adopt, look at the biblical worldview and from that perspective, that then someone walks from this conversation and says, okay, I am white, or I am, part of majority culture, and I can move forward in a way that is part of that shalom bringing, as opposed to trying to be defensive and keeping myself safe.
No, it's a great question. It's the question, and I'll give one of the cliche answers. There's a book or books for that. And so, and I mentioned Jamar Tisby earlier. So he followed up his book on The Color of Compromise with this, but I know we're just doing audio, but since you all can see me on video, you'll be able to see it.
Yeah.
So it's called How to Fight Racism, Courageous Christianity, and the Journey Toward Racial Justice. And so, and Tisby wrote this book in response to sort of that very question of, so what do we do? What's a good starting point? How do we start to move towards, particularly from the Christian perspective, racial justice? And so, to get the full version, I'd encourage folks to pick up the book and to dive into it. I think it gives some really helpful framing. But a quick sort of broad view for that for us as individuals is that he provides a model for individual commitment to racial justice called the ARC of racial justice. And ARC is an acronym. So it's ARC, and that stands for awareness, relationships, and commitment. I think awareness is pretty self-explanatory, but it's essentially, okay, becoming aware of, not just the broader conversation on race and racism, but what are some of those internalized things that I maybe have, inside of me. And so there's one of the ways that I've done that and that I'd encourage people to do is that Harvard created a project called Project Implicit. And so if folks Google that, it helps you to uncover what some of your personal implicit biases are. So that could be a way to start a journey towards understanding what some of the internalized racism that I have, or what are some of the prejudices that I need to unpack in my own personal life. While again, also, so becoming aware of oneself as well as being aware of the broader conversation around race. So that's awareness, the A. So then you have the R of relationships. And so he talks about the fact that building authentic, relationships across areas of racial and ethnic difference, not having someone as my, racism Wikipedia or Google, but doing life with somebody on an authentic connection over a long period of time, where there's mutual love and respect. And, it's not that you're having like a book club every day and talking about racism, but just genuine connections with people, having real relationship with them, being mutually in each other's lives over time. And there's there's lots of studies that show, even for children, some friends of mine who actually live in this community, Dr. Sandy and Larry Feldman, and they've been doing this kind of work for a number of years. They're really mentors of mine. And they recently wrote a book called Building Bridges Across the Racial Divide, in which they talk about the program that they developed, where they bring together, you know, kids from different racial backgrounds at a young age, like starting in like first grade, like first through fifth grade, and having intentional immersive experiences with them, and how over time, you know, those kinds of initiatives have been shown to curb things like, you know, bias and things of that nature. And that can work as well for folks who are older. So relationships is a real key. And then lastly, of course, you know, there's the C of commitment. And the other thing that I'll say is that this isn't sort of like a linear or sequential model. So you could be doing all three of these things at the same time. You don't have to like, okay, I can't commit until I'm fully aware and I have these relationships. Like, no, you can do any one of these at any particular time. And commitment is just a frame which helps us understand, all right, what are some of my personal, you know, and more corporate action steps that I'm going to take. So is that getting involved in, you know, my local city council or township and looking at what some of the structural issues may be there in that community? Is it empowering my church to think about the neighborhood that it sits in and what are some of the different issues that folks there are dealing with? Has the neighborhood quote unquote changed over time? If so, what are the reasons for that? Is there any housing discrimination that informs why, you know, as we drive into church, you know, we're seeing different shades now than we used to? What's behind that? What are the economic implications of it? You know, and what are some more longer term, what are some nonprofits in my community that are really doing the work that we can support, that we can come alongside, that we could inject some life into, that are fighting for a racial justice in our area? So how can I commit individually and corporately in the institutions that I'm a part of to making things better? So there are other models out there, but I found Jamar's ARC model to be very useful. You can fit almost anything under those three categories to help give you the right framing of how you're working towards that particular goal of racial justice in your context. And so I'd really encourage folks to dive deeper into it as they're seeking to do this. And he postures this as courageous Christianity. It does take courage as Christians to step into this space, but I truly believe that in doing so, we will more better reflect the cause of Christ and more fully embody his gospel at a time and in a world that so desperately needs it.
Yeah, man.
Oh, man. So strong.
Well, we know you got to run, Mike, but I just want to say thank you so much for being on the podcast. It's the perspective that you have of especially like some of the specific examples that you've shared. I know are going to be really important for people in my sphere of life to hear, as just like, wow, okay, so this is still happening. This is real, you know, examples mm-hmm. that, you know, we're just unaware of because we're not faced with it every day. But even beyond that, into the, you know, you're now working in a space where some of the things that maybe you've seen in churches or in church institutions, now you're actually having to face the work of working within one. So just, man, more power to you in all of that. And thank you for serving in the ways that you have, serving the kingdom of God in those ways that you have.
Bro, I appreciate that. Oh, go ahead, Anthony. Sure.
No, bro, I was just going to echo a similar thing. Just want to thank you for who you are, what you do. And I get the honor of being able to interact with you regularly. So what an honor it is, Bishop. And but seriously, bro, I feel like I intersect and interact with a lot of friends who are either ex-Adventists or have deconstructed or have contemplated leaving, have left, are leaving, the whole gray area. And I feel like for many, it's like, why even stay? Like what is there of value, really? How does this bring value to my life? And to be able to say, you know, we started this podcast because we were having conversations and we just wanted to have honest conversations about things and about conversations we felt like were never had. And to be able to say, wow, like being part of a community that like being able to at least maybe isn't even current, but envision a community that is committed to these things, that that is envisioning God's vision for humanity of being reconciled to each other, like the healing of the races, like to be able to say, hey, as a community, we're committing to that. Wow. That's, I feel like that's something I want to be a part of, you know? So I feel like that's so strong. I just want to thank you, man, for your work and what you do and for sharing today. So.
I appreciate you both, man. Beautifully said. And I just want to, you know, for what it's worth on that topic you just raised, Anthony, you know, I think for folks my age, I guess I'm a little bit of an older millennial and then, you know, going younger than that. You know, I think we really resonate with the idea of being in like, in liminal spaces, like sort of just being in that in between.
For sure.
And Robert Chow Romero, which I mentioned earlier in his book, Brown Church, talks a lot about that, how he's of Mexican and South Asian background. And he talks about, you know, never being Mexican enough for his Mexican family, but never being South Asian enough for a South Asian family. And also working within Chicana studies and, you know, never being, I guess, sort of progressive enough for his colleagues, but then being a Christian in that space, never being Christian enough for, you know, his church setting.
For the Christians.
So always sort of existing in the in-between, bro, you know? And I think that there's so many of us that are there in those liminal spaces. He actually calls it spiritual borderlands is how he describes
that's good.
And so for the folks that are in those spaces, that are in that borderlands, that are... there's another scholar that I respect a lot that calls it sometimes being on the edge of the inside. So like you're right on that border, almost maybe straddling both sides of the fence. I just want to honor and affirm where those people are, man. Man, God is there in the midst of that liminal space, in the midst of those borderlands, as you're right on the edge. And wherever God takes them going forward, as you were saying, Anthony, if they find themselves as a part of that broader beloved community, that broader a narrative of belonging and inclusion and of an expanded capacity to love that I believe that Christ is wanting to bring into a reality in this world, then wherever that space takes them, you know, they're going to find themselves right in the center of the heart of God. And so I just say, keep going, keep searching, keep believing to the extent that you can, and keep responding to that light. And as you continue to take one step forward and then the next, brighter days will come.
Thanks, Mike. Thank you again for being on the podcast, man.
For sure. All the best, guys. Take care.
Thanks, right. Mike.
Peace.
Well, that was our conversation on race, and we genuinely hope that it was meaningful and that you were able to be stretched or grow or find out things about this conversation you hadn't before. I know I certainly did in the course of the conversation. And I know there's a question. Why is it that only Anthony and I are on this podcast? And if any of you know us, Anthony and I are brown and Sean and Eric are white. And so what we did is we just kicked Sean and Eric off the podcast. We just decided that it was time for Anthony and I to take over. And from now on, it will only be Anthony and I will take the whole of the conversation. So I just want you to know that. No, I'm just kidding. Sean and Eric are still part of the podcast. They just couldn't be at this specific episode because of the time that it was being recorded at. So it just so happens to be the conversation on race. There's nothing fishy about it. All of us friends have had numerous conversations on race and we'll continue to. But yeah, they couldn't be there with us today. But as always, tune in next time for our next podcast. You can also join in the conversation on Facebook and Instagram at Seeking What They Sought. And we hope to see you at the next one. See, here? I don't know.